MechCast, Tuesday, October 16th, 2018. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. I hope you are having a wonderful week, and things are going well for you. Things are pretty good around here, and it looks like we have a number of things in the Apple and Macintosh world to go over this week. I'm excited to talk to you about a few of them. Actually, I'm kind of keeping an eye on my feed and Twitter and things like that, because, man, we should be getting some sort of an announcement about a possible event, if one's going to happen. I would think that's going to happen soon. We'll talk about that in this episode. We're also going to get into some new information on processors that might show up in a future Mac, maybe a Mac Pro. A number of acquisitions or possible acquisitions that happened this week. Apple's video service, we got a little more details on how that might roll out, and Apple doing some new stuff with mapping. So we're going to get into all of that. We've got some follow-up on our conversations surrounding two-factor authentication. Going to fill you in on something that I missed last time. I talked about my nuke and pave of Mac OS Mojave. Your kids might be trying to get around your screen time stuff. We'll give you some advice and wisdom on how you might deal with that. And we'll talk voice assistants and Siri and HomePod and apps and all kinds of fun stuff. And so I don't want to delay. We do have a lot of things to get into this episode. So I want to kick things off with this iPad Pro event. We are expecting Apple to release some new iPad Pros. We've been talking about all the rumors over the past few months here on the MacCast. Obviously, that didn't happen at Apple's iPhone event in September. We've got the iPhone XR on the horizon this month as well, and so I fully expect, at least by the end of this week, we might hear that invites go out, although there could be a wrinkle, because I think on the last episode of the MacCast, I told you about my timeline prediction. I figured that invites would be going out on the 18th, and we would be having an event on the 20th, on the 25th. I didn't put my calendar in front of me, but in just a couple days. So I'm expecting Thursday announcements to be going out, and then we would have an event on the 25th. But a little bit of news came out, and it puts a wrinkle in that timeline, because Tim Cook is scheduled to be doing a keynote, not an Apple keynote, but a keynote on the 24th at the 2018 International Conference of Data Protection and Privacy Commissioners. That's in Brussels, in Belgium. So I guess he does have access to a private plane that could be flying him back and forth, but that might be a little bit tight for him to get back to do a keynote on the 25th. Now, that said, I thought, well, maybe then he could do it on the 23rd, the day before that event, which would be Tuesday next week, but then we would expect invites to have gone out. And as I sit here recording this episode, it's about 11:30 on Tuesday, and I have seen hide nor hair of any event announcements going out. So it's looking like it could possibly get pushed all the way to the 30th with maybe invites going out on the 23rd. I really don't know at this point. I'm really a little bit confused. I kind of still have a feeling we might get the event on the 25th. But then you have the iPhone XR going on sale on the 19th. Pre-orders happen this Friday, and then that's shipping on the 26th. So the end of October is looking pretty busy for an event. So does that mean we're not going to get any event at all, and Apple's just going to secretly roll new iPad up or iPad Pro updates out? The changes seem significant enough to me that I would think they would hold an event for this. So I don't know if that means it gets pushed to November. I'm really confused at this point. How about you? I don't know how you're feeling about it. But as far as what we might be getting, we are getting more details from the rumor mill. The specs and features seem to be solidifying. I think there's almost no doubt at this point that we are going to get a design that is going to be almost bezel-free, adopting a lot of the features from the recent iPhone X and iPhone XS designs. But there's likely not to be a notch. So that is good news for those of you who are not fans of the notch, it looks like they are going to fit the true depth camera system and the Face ID technology and all that stuff into a bezel. So it's not going to be bezel free, but there'll be enough of a bezel to hide and build in that stuff. But a lot of the comp designs and speculative designs we're seeing surfacing online, I think, look great. You know, a big giant sheet of glass, 10.5 inches, 12.9 inches. So physical dimension wise, they're expected to be a little bit smaller. Screen size about the same. We'll talk about that 10.5 inch screen though, which some people thought for a while was going to be 11 inch screen. Yeah, we've got a little more details on that. But just a few other things. It's also expected that it will have a new or updated smart connector that could be positioned on the back of the device, sort of back toward the bottom near the connector. Apple will reportedly open up that for third-party support, I guess, further, because the current smart connector, there are a couple of third-party accessories for, but that would open up further. And I'm curious about that connector, though, because it's expected that Apple may add a USB-C port instead of a Lightning connector. And this makes sense. The rumor is that it's because they want to support 4K HDR video out, and USB-C is going to allow them to do that. And they're even saying in the rumors there would be settings, control settings, to adjust the external display. So this would be more video out like we have now with the adapter cable, but now you wouldn't need the HDMI, you know, Lightning to HDMI dongle. You'd be able to go straight USB-C out to, I guess you'd still need maybe an HDMI dongle or going into another USB-C display. So I guess you could go straight into USB-C display without kind of anything other than a cable. But I think it does make sense to me that Apple would move to USB-C on the iPad Pro before they do it with the iPhone. We were thinking maybe they could do it on the iPhone. That didn't happen this time around. I think Apple is slowly moving us that direction. And because the iPad is often seen, I think, almost as a notebook replacement for a lot of people, I think it makes sense to bring the connector to the iPad. But on that smart connector being on the back, it looks like where it's positioned, any accessory you would connect would cover up, or, again, I don't know how they're going to use that attachment if it's on the back of the iPad. I would imagine there's something that sort of has to kind of wrap around, and because it's down on that end near where the connector, physical connector, would be, it seems like it would cover it up, which means, you know, I don't know about you, but with my iPad Pro, on occasion, I am using it with the smart keyboard and plugged into power. So that would potentially rule that out. And I guess Apple's never been afraid of that, right? Blocking the connector for other reasons, or removing the connector, or having only one connector available. So like if you wanted to, on your iPhone, use the Lightning to 3.5 millimeter adapter, right? You don't have access to charging. So they never shied away from that. I'm just curious to see how all of that stuff is going to work. And for sure, I think we're going to hear people complaining that the new smart connector design is blocking that port. As far as the processor that's expected to be in the new updated iPad Pros, it's expected to be a version of the A12 Bionic, maybe the one that we've seen or did see in the iPhone XS or XS Max, but typically Apple tweaks that, so we might get what Apple calls their X series, like an A12X, and that usually means an improved or more cores in the graphics and the GPU and things like that. As far as screen resolution, there is a rumor that the new models may have the exact same display resolution, 2,244 pixels by 1,668 pixels for the 10.5-inch model, and 2,732 by 2,048 for the 12.9-inch model. That's only weird in the fact that leading up to this event, we've been hearing rumors of an 11-inch version of the display. And if there was going to be an 11-inch version of the iPad Pro, so 11 inches and 12.9 inches, you would expect that smaller display resolution to go up a little bit so that Apple could maintain the high PPI ratios, pixel per inch ratios, in that display. So that's a little bit confusing. We might not be getting an 11-inch model on the display. It might still be a 10.5-inch model at this point. It's also expected we're going to get an updated 9.7-inch iPad. And then finally, rumors are saying that the base model, the 10.5-inch model, may be even thinner, coming in at just 5.9 millimeters, it being that small. And this information came from Slash Leaks. That would mean it would not be thick enough to have a 3.5 millimeter headphone jack. So we could get just a USB-C port on the new iPad Pros, and of course that means to fans of the 3.5 millimeter jack and 3.5 millimeter headphones or physically connected headphones, that is going to be a little bit of a disappointment. Frankly, to me, it's not surprising. Apple has gotten rid of the headphone jack on the iPhones, and it seemed like this next update for the iPads was going to be the transition where they would move away from that. Apple fully invested in us using wireless headphones, either Bluetooth or Apple's own AirPods, which are fabulous, but of course are expensive. So there's a lot of people out there that really have high-end headphones that use a 3.5 millimeter jack. Often people feel it's more important on the iPad because the iPad is positioned more as a content creation device, especially the iPad Pro at this point. That means like podcasters and audio engineers and folks like that do want to be able to connect in and use things like GarageBand or, you know, to make podcasts and things like that. And often you'd want to be able to plug in some headphones. But, you know, it would not surprise me to see that going away at all. And whether or not this is going to happen, new iPads this fall, you know, there have been more hints. 9to5 Mac found an onboarding reference in the latest version of iOS 12 beta that went out to developers, something referencing an iPad 2018 fall model. So it is expected that we're going to get these. And I fully expect Apple to have some sort of event. I'm just questioning at this point whether or not it will happen in October and may or may not be pushed back to November. So I'm going to slightly revise my prediction. I feel about 50-50 that this event might happen on the 25th. I'm feeling more like it may be happening on the 30th, the last day of the month, or maybe even pushed into the first week, first or second week of November. So we'll have to see. A few other possible things we're expecting at the event. It is expected that Apple will give us some updates to the Mac lineup. Many of our Mac models are overdue, including way overdue is the Mac Mini. So we are expecting some sort of Mac Mini update or announcement. We're also expecting some tweaks to the MacBook Pro. There's been that long rumored lower priced version of the MacBook Pro, possibly an update to the MacBook Air. But I'm really kind of feeling like Apple is going to finally merge the MacBook Air and MacBook Pro lineup into a single series, into a single edition, and that will get the new lower-priced MacBook Pro, maybe some updates to the current MacBook Pro models, and that will fill out the lineup. Will we get a new size, though, is the question, because we do have the size differentiation between the 12-inch MacBook and the 13-inch MacBook Air. So the question becomes, do they stick with the 12-inch form factor or do they offer a 13-inch MacBook? And I kind of feel they'll just stick with the single size, just in different configurations, although that may not appeal to a lot of people. Also, a lot of people feel like the big draw to the MacBook Air is, of course, the ports, but I fully expect that Apple will only adopt USB-C going forward. The question will be, how many USB-C ports will they put in there? And who really knows, but we are expecting an update there. I would also expect maybe a quiet revision to the iMac lineup, the standard iMac lineup. Of course, we got the iMac Pro, but the last update to the iMac line was 2017. So they're kind of overdue for a little kind of spec bump, and that could just happen quietly in the background, although that hasn't been in the rumors. So that's just my own pure kind of speculation based on nothing at this point. But I don't know. How do you feel about this stuff? A few other odds and ends happening this week related to the stuff we have now. iOS 12 update, iOS 12.0.1 was released. This is good because it fixed some issues for new iPhone XS and XS Max owners. Fixed an issue where some people were having charging problems. We talked about that on the last episode of the MacCast when physically connecting the lightning cable. Charging wasn't working for some folks, so that should be fixed if you've run into that issue. It also fixes an issue with the XS family where devices would reconnect to the 2.4 gigahertz band on a mixed 2 and 5 gigahertz network. I don't know if I actually had that problem because I don't know if I would have noticed. I do run an AirPort Extreme, and I know I have both bands running, but I don't know that I have any way to really check in real time which band I'm on. And I'm not sure that it really matters all that much, right? Because really 5 gigahertz is more about getting more range. Speed is not really going to be impacted too much. But if that's something that concerns you, that is supposedly fixed as well. Another thing that I didn't notice, I think because I use my smart keyboard mostly on my iPad Pro when I'm doing keyboard stuff, is that Apple had moved the location of the 1-2-3 key on the iPad virtual keyboard. That has been moved back to the original position. So if that was bugging you, grab the 12.0.1 update, which is available now. Of course, there were a few other bug fixes for things like Bluetooth and some a few other things. So grab that update if you haven't yet. And of course, we do know that the new beta is out for iOS 12, iOS 12.1 beta. So Apple actively working on fixes and updates for the current version of iOS. Another thing that happened this week was Apple told developers through the App Store support page that iOS 12 is now on 53% of active devices introduced in the past 4 years, which is kind of an interesting new stat. And, you know, they've always kind of said how quick the adoption rate to the latest operating system was happening. They let developers know that so they knew what they could support inside their apps. In that same stat, they also did say that 50% of all active devices, iOS devices, are now running iOS 12. 40% are running iOS 11, and all the other devices out there are supposedly running some other version of the operating system. That means that iOS 12 appears to be having a faster uptick rate than even iOS 11. I'm going to guess this is in a big part due to the pretty well-publicized fact that iOS 12 runs faster on older devices. So if you have an older device, there is an incentive, a big incentive, to upgrade to iOS 12. So I think that's helping with the adoption rate. Of course, the adoption rate being quick and a lot of devices being converted to the latest version is also very good for developers as well as users. And it also says a lot, I think, for Apple's ability to support and offer the latest version of the operating system to older devices, something that is a challenge for other device makers, right? Because Apple controls everything from the hardware to the software, they can really make sure the new operating systems work further back with older models. The only thing with stats like this that I really don't like is the comparison that often comes up in our community of Apple's device adoption or operating system adoption rates versus other platforms. As a matter of fact, even Apple likes to use this stat in their keynotes to show how fragmented, say, the Android ecosystem is. And it bugs me because I don't think it's a very fair equation. The parameters of the equation are very different. And Android is often up against, you know, going against approvals that have to go through the carriers and all that stuff, all those other challenges. So yes, it's good that we as iOS owners get to use the latest, greatest operating system on more devices, and that does help with the adoption rate. But I also feel like Apple kind of really pushes you to upgrade as well. And you all know what I'm talking about, right? Anytime a new operating system comes out, you just get constant alerts that there's a new version and that you should upgrade. So I think a lot of people are sort of even forced to upgrade whether they want to or not. Now, luckily, I think Apple does a good job of offering benefits to people for upgrading. So it's not always necessarily a bad thing, but it causes problems occasionally. But just again, the comparison, I don't like this comparison between iOS and Android, at least on this stat. I think there's a lot of other things we can compare and we can make arguments that iOS is better at certain things. But this is just one of those that, you know, seems a little bit silly to me. But good. Adoption rate, we like having fast adoption rates. And I think that's ultimately a good thing for, like I said, developers and users alike. And then finally, the other thing I want to talk about is iPhone XR. It is arriving soon. It goes on sale this Friday as I record this podcast. So if you are planning to purchase an iPhone XR and you want to use your iPhone upgrade program, I would say check your eligibility now. Get that done early. Don't wait until the last minute until you're trying to, you know, order at midnight on Friday. Also, make sure that you pre-qualify. And another bit of advice, you can go into Apple's App Store app on your iOS device right now, or into the, you know, the online store, and you can pre-set up your order. So, you know, pick out your phone, pick out which carrier you're going to go with, get your pre-approvals done, make sure that you are ready to go. And I did this for my iPhone XS order, and it made it seamless and smooth. I was in and out of the App Store within a matter of minutes. And while you're doing it, I know it's easy to get caught up in the fray, but I'm also point this out. Just make sure you're reading everything as you're going along. Make sure you're using the right credit card, all those things. Double check everything beforehand, but also be careful on order day because it's easy to get caught up in the moment. And I do occasionally get emails from people who say, you know, I went through the whole process and I ended up on the wrong upgrade program, because Apple does have, you know, the standard upgrade program now, but they also have a sort of interest-free, you're not on the upgrade plan, but you can pay in payments program. And a few people ended up on that program thinking they were getting into the upgrade program. So just make sure you've got everything set up ahead of time so that things go smoothly for you when you're ordering your iPhone XR on Friday. And then something else related to the XR that we're hearing about, there are reports that Apple may have a new clear case available for the XR models so that you don't cover up all those pretty new colors that you can get your iPhone in. I'm particularly interested in the yellow version. I think it looks gorgeous. I like yellow just as a color. It's bright and cheerful. And so now you can get this clear case. You know, it, of course, is Apple priced. I would assume it's also Apple quality because it is a $40 clear case for your iPhone XR. So I expect that to show up maybe on pre-order day or slightly after. They haven't really said when Apple will make this available, but it supposedly is in the works. And then as far as how iPhone XR sales are going to go, we have some little hints from Apple analyst Ming-Chi Kuo. He told his investors that he thinks iPhone XR sales are going to be, quote, better than expected. He predicts that Apple could ship 38 million in their first fiscal quarter of the year. That's the fourth quarter of 2018 for most of the rest of us. And he does expect total sales for the Apple's first fiscal quarter of 2019 to be 83 million iPhones sold. He also thinks that post-holiday sales, or the post-holiday drop-off that usually happens, will be a little bit less with the iPhone XR than it was with the iPhone 8. So he thinks that while last year with iPhone 8 sales after that holiday quarter, Apple saw about a 50% drop in the sales rate, he thinks the iPhone XR will only drop about 30%. So that's, you know, basically iPhone XR sales are going to be remain very popular. It's going to be a popular model in Apple's lineup. He's predicting 60 million iPhones sold in Apple's second fiscal quarter of 2019. And the iPhone XR accounting for roughly about 50% of that. And I think I'm right there with him. I am super excited. I don't know how excited you are, but I'm super excited about the iPhone XR. I think it is a beautiful option. And I think a lot of iPhone buyers are going to be really receptive to it. I think it has a lot of broad appeal, especially considering the specs and all of the camera stuff. It is a really great addition of the iPhone. Probably one of the best ones we've seen in a while in terms of its price to specs. I think it is really good. I mean, it's still expensive. It's still a premium phone at a premium price. I know that there's other options out there. If you want to save more money and go the Android route, you can. But I think as far as where it fits into Apple's lineup, it's really great. And I'm excited to see what happens with it. I'm also excited to hear from those of you out there who pick one up. So if you do pick one up and get it on the 25th, or 26th, rather, send us some feedback. Let us know what you think of it. What are your initial first impressions, especially if you're upgrading from, say, an iPhone 10, maybe to a 10R, which is an upgrade I personally considered. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. So shoot us some feedback. I know we're a couple weeks away from that, but when you get there, shoot us some feedback to maccast@gmail.com. So Intel actually had an announcement. This is something I don't cover too much here on the MacCast. You know, anytime Intel brings out new processors, you know, and they do it quite frequently. There's not a lot to talk about, but this time around, they revealed their latest high-spec processors, meaning their Xeon processors, which could be the ones that would be destined for a 2019 Mac Pro. I know, we've been waiting forever for a Mac Pro. Apple says they are delivering one. They're saying it's going to come sometime in 2019. We don't know when it's going to happen, but Intel did announce their new high-end processor lineup. They covered the Xeons and the new 9th generation Core processors. All of them have high core counts, including some designs going all the way up to 5 gigahertz and 8 core designs. But for the Xeon, the beast that could find its way into the 2019 MacBook Pro, it gets really interesting. This thing is massive. It is a powerhouse. It is a beast of a chip, 28 cores in a 56-thread chip called the Xeon W3175X. It's clocked at just 3.1 gigahertz, but it can be boosted up to 4.3 gigahertz and has support for 6-channel DDR4 memory controller, allowing it to support up to, get this, 512 gigabytes of RAM. So it would be perfect for a massive Mac Pro machine. I think anybody who is a pro user would love to have this kind of raw power. It is hot, literally. The processor is hot. It has a thermal design point of 265 watts. So power hungry, super hot. I guess it could double as a oven to bake a snack for your late night rendering sessions. You know, you want to bake up some fries or a baked potato. Yep, you're good to go on that thing. It's huge. So obviously you're going to have to deal with a lot of thermal and cooling issues, but I don't think, you know, if Apple gets their design right on the Mac Pro, that should not be an issue. They should be able to figure that out. And this seems like the kind of thing that they really need to deliver. Of course, it's going to be super expensive when it comes out, the Mac Pro, but, you know, we've come to expect that from Mac Pros. This Xeon processor is going to be available in December, so right before 2019, so the timing seems right. You know, who knows if this is the processor that'll make it into the Mac Pro, but man, just dreaming or thinking about it based on the specs is really, really good. The other processors they announced, of course, were the new, as I just mentioned, were the 9th generation Core processors. That's the i5, i7, and i9 designs. They're ranging from a 6-core i5 9600K with a base clock speed of 3.7 gigahertz all the way up to a 16-thread Core i9 processor, the 9900K, which has a base clock speed of 3.6 gigahertz and can rise under boost to 5 gigahertz. So some screaming processors. All the new Core processors are starting to ship this month, but because they all have a thermal design point of about 95 watts, Apple is unlikely to use them in their desktop models like the iMac or the MacBook Pro design. So they're not really fit for that because of the whole, you know, thermal and power requirements of those chips. So we're not expecting those to be in there. But that still does leave the question of, you know, Apple has kind of got a lot of models in the Mac lineup that are overdue for an update. And we are getting some news this week that the lack of new Mac offerings, you know, outside the MacBook Pro updates that we had recently, does seem to be impacting Mac sales a little bit. Both Gartner and IDC released their latest numbers for the last quarter, the third quarter of this year, as far as the state of the worldwide PC market. And it shows that Apple's worldwide share of the PC market, at least according to the Gartner numbers, slipped about 8% year over year from 2017 to 2018 in the third quarter. Apple shipped about 500,000 fewer Macs in the third quarter of this year than they did last year, according to Gartner. IDC also released a similar report with even lower shipment numbers. They showed that Apple's shipments were down 11% year over year. So overall, Apple shipping fewer Macs, at least in the third quarter of this year. And so that does bring the question, you know, what does that mean exactly for Apple? I'm not too concerned about it. Apple is going to update their lineup, but it does feel like at this point they're really due. And again, hopefully at the October event, we're going to see some new Mac stuff, specifically the Mac Mini, but I'd really like them to see them rev the iMac too, because as great as the iMac Pro is, that's obviously targeted at a very specific end of the market. And I know there's a lot of you out there who are iMac fans. I love the iMac personally. I use notebooks, but if I were to buy a desktop, and I've actually often considered it because my MacBook Pro basically exists as a desktop at this point, the iMac offers a lot of, again, power to performance to price value, I think, and Apple is overdue to update it. So hopefully they update it. There are already some great existing processors from Intel that are there and available for that. Of course, we always have the rumors that Apple might do their own processors at some point. So, you know, state of the Mac, a lot of people, you know, questioning it, but I think Apple is doing all right, but they need to deliver us something in that realm soon, and I'm sure you probably agree with me. Moving into a little bit of Apple's latest business stuff, a couple acquisitions or possible acquisitions to talk about. Apple has reportedly acquired a company called Spectral, a Danish computer vision startup. This appears to have happened late last year, like in December, but was just noticed now, I guess, by a Danish newspaper. The deal is reportedly for $30 million, and this company has technology that can intelligently separate people and objects from their original backgrounds in photos and videos. So yeah, it's basically like live real-time green screening, but the solution that Spectral developed uses deep neural networks and spectral graph theory. I don't even know what that is, but it just sounds cool, right? So it can actually do this process in real time at 60 frames per second on a device, so like on your smartphone or iPad. This is like really, really cool stuff. And one of the founders of the company is now listed as the manager for computational imaging at Apple Inc. on his LinkedIn account. And again, he shows having started at Apple back in December. So as far as how this technology is going to fit into Apple's sort of business and where it's going, I think there's a lot of applications for it across the board. So who really knows? And Apple doesn't talk about this stuff. You know, they just give their standard statement that they acquire companies from time to time, and they don't really comment on that. But just in looking at the technology and thinking about it, you'd think, oh, well, it's perfect for, say, like Final Cut or for iMovie. But also, it could have, I think, ramifications and show up in other areas. I think Apple is going to use it in a broader sense across a range of their products. So it could be everything from things inside the iMessage app with Animoji and Emoji, maybe inside the Clips app, but I'm thinking it even has applications all the way through potential future products like their self-driving vehicle project to separate, you know, humans and objects from their backgrounds, to do collision avoidance and that sort of stuff, all the way through augmented reality, right? If you can actually pick out people as they move through an environment in real time, that has some significant applications maybe inside AR. So it seems like a great acquisition and a great price. And I fully expect it to be showing up in a broad range of what Apple is doing in the products that they're actually delivering. The other company that Apple reportedly acquired was a San Francisco-based music analytics startup. This is coming from Axios. I'm going to call them Asai. It's Asaii. I think that's probably the right pronunciation. This was a deal reportedly worth about $100 million. This company makes an analytics platform, or was developing an analytics platform for artists and repertoire, A&R reps, basically music industry folks. Their system, again, uses machine learning, and the idea behind it was to help music labels and A&R folks discover, track, and manage artists using data from social networks and streaming music services. Basically trying to figure out, you know, who's the hot up-and-coming artists coming out of social media, out of services like YouTube and SoundCloud. A lot of people were saying, you know, how to find the next Justin Bieber. This was supposedly going to use machine learning and technology to allow you to do that. They also had a companion product that was a recommendation API for music services like Spotify and YouTube and Apple Music and stuff like that. So you could buy into that, and it could help your recommendation engines with figuring out, you know, what the hot tracks are and what's popular and things like that. So the report was that Apple had acquired this company. The company made an announcement, I think, on Twitter that it was going to shut down its operations on October 14th. And the three founders were now working for Apple. So it was looking like this is what happened. But then TechCrunch went out to try and get a statement from Apple, and Apple refused to even give their stock acquisition statement, so that blanket statement that they give. And that led them to conclude that this wasn't a case of Apple acquiring the company, but rather simply hiring the three founders, and therefore that company was shutting down. And Mac Rumors also had a source that said the deal was worth, quote, way, way less than $100 million. So that also seems to lead to this speculation that really what happened was Apple hired these three guys. They're going to be working on similar technologies and stuff, probably for Apple Music inside Apple. But again, Apple doesn't comment on any of this stuff, so we don't know what's going on. But fully expect that this is something related to, you know, Apple Music and Apple trying to get more data and use more machine learning technology, both for recommendation engines, but also probably for helping artists and other people coming to the platform with figuring out how to do marketing and roll all that stuff in. So that's going on this week. And then there was also another major deal. This was not, again, an acquisition, but a major deal to acquire some power management technology and talent from one of Apple's longtime suppliers for power chips, Dialog. We've talked about Dialog in the past. Apple had notified them that Apple was going to be moving into creating their own power management technology in the coming years, and Dialog was kind of feeling the heat because about 75% of their business was coming from developing chips for Apple, so they were going to have to actually go out and try and find other technologies. Well, now Apple has reportedly stepped in to help the company out a little bit in the transition. In a deal reportedly worth a total of about $600 million, Apple is going to license power management technology from Dialog. They're also going to acquire about 300 of Dialog's existing employees. That represents about 16% of the firm's current workforce. They're going to take over a number of Dialog facilities in the UK, Italy, and Germany. Initially, they're going to give them a $300 million upfront investment, and then later, over the next 3 years, they're going to be investing another $300 million. I guess this is kind of a pre-sale for chip orders over the next 3 years. And really what's going on here is it's believed that Apple is, again, bringing their own design and power management in-house. They actually announced this back in November of last year, as I said. And overall, this deal with Dialog is going to do a lot to help that effort. So they're bringing in additional resources, talent, and technology to help with that effort. And as you know, power management is a huge thing in all of Apple's products, from their notebook lineup all the way through iPhones and iPads and down to the Apple Watch. So this acquisition should help with that moving forward. It should be no surprise to anyone who listens to this podcast or who follows Apple at all that Apple has been actively and very aggressively working on original video content for what we've been told is a new video streaming service. And so we know that's going on. They're making shows, they're acquiring content, but what we really haven't known and all we've been able to do is speculate about is what or how are they going to roll out this service? You know, what's it going to cost? What's it going to be? Is it going to be something that's rolled into Apple Music? I've talked about it a lot here on the show. We do know it's pretty firm at this point from the rumor mill that that Apple is going to move forward on this sometime in 2019. But this week we got a report from CNBC that had some shocking new information. And the biggest thing was that Apple may release this video content for free for existing owners of Apple products. That means if you own an iPhone, an iPad, an Apple TV, you will get access to, according to the CNBC report and their sources, you will get access to Apple's original video content for free. So the idea here is that Apple is going to mix in their content inside the TV app with content from other premium services outside of Apple, services like HBO or Stars. And so basically, I guess the idea is that you would use the TV app to access all of this content rather than separate third-party apps. So if you use the TV app now, you know that to get access to other subscription services like HBO or Amazon Prime or something like that, you install the Amazon Prime app and then you kind of connect it to the Apple TV app. This would be more everything integrated into the single app. You don't need any other separate third-party app, but if you want to get a premium subscription service or get access to premium content, you would purchase that or buy it as a subscription through the TV app. And I assume, they don't talk about this in the CNBC piece, but I assume that Apple then makes money through a revenue share of that subscription fee like they do now. I think they get about 15% in most of the deals that they've done with HBO and Netflix and stuff like that. That was adjusted recently. We don't know all the firm details on that, but that is kind of the speculation. So what it's feeling like to me is that Apple is planning on taking kind of what I would just call a freemium approach to television, where it wants their shows to be the thing that is like the draw to bring you into the television app, into the Apple TV service. And then while you're there, they would upsell you on their partner premium subscription services. And I thought this was a little bit strange at first because it seems like Apple has a huge opportunity to bundle, and that's where I thought they were going with it, right? We talked about this on past episodes of the MacCast, where they would bundle, I think ideally, Apple Music, their new video content, video streaming service, and then also a newspaper and magazine service. We know they acquired the company Texture, which specialized in that, and bundle all that together for one price, say $12.99 or $14.99, something in that price range US per month, and then you would get all of those services. And it would be a huge, I think, revenue driver. So this model is actually a lot different and I think somewhat interesting because to me, it starts to feel like TV was when I was a kid. Like it's sort of bringing it back around to the fact that, you know, you would get TV service and then you kind of had these free ad-supported networks that had content that was, you know, kind of more family-friendly. It had oversight. It didn't go too deep into the adult kind of content area, right? Even primetime television had sort of rules that it had to follow. And we have been hearing that Apple has been very much demanding with these new shows that they kind of have this PG feel to them and they don't really go outside that realm. So they have a broad appeal to the widest range of audiences. And if you think about the fact that maybe the idea here is to draw people into the service that you could then upsell them on the premium channels that maybe have more of the adult stuff, just like when I grew up, if you wanted that, you paid for HBO or you paid for Showtime or Cinemax, and then you got the cable content at a premium price, but kind of the base TV service was just included for one bundled price. In this case, it would be free, but this gets really pretty interesting. So something to think about, and I think it could be a huge coup for Apple to do it this way. They already, in a way, are, you know, releasing their video services like Carpool Karaoke to everyone for free through Apple Music. So this would just be somewhat of an extension of that. And I think that would be awesome if Apple wants to do that and they can find a way to work, make that work financially. I just worry that it feels like they're leaving a lot of potential money on the table. But, you know, with their current financial situation, maybe they don't care about that. Maybe this is about a bigger thing and it's going to be really interesting. So interesting to think about. I kind of still feel like they would go with that overall bundled service, Apple Music, newspapers and magazines and video content under one price. And I think there'd be a lot of people, myself included, who would go for that. But however they do this, I am still and continue to be very excited about what Apple is doing in the video space, just on multiple levels. So this is really cool. I don't know what you think. shoot me some feedback, some comments, maccast@gmail.com. One other quick entertainment-related thing related to Apple and Apple Music. Apple announced a new partnership this week with Lyric, the Lyric database Genius. What this means is that you can go onto the Genius website now or use the Genius app on your iOS device and connect it to your Apple Music account. And when you do that, if you're searching for lyrics or music information within the website or the app, you can now play the full song related to that lyric right on the lyric page or right inside the app. So that's what Genius gets out of this partnership. Apple, for their part, is going to get more access or increased access to information for their lyrics feature inside Apple Music. So they're going to be able to tap into the Genius database and get more lyrics for more songs within Apple Music. So that's a nice little partnership, especially if you're like me and a subscriber to Apple's music service and you enjoy looking up lyrics. You know, occasionally it's hit and miss on the lyrics. So I think anytime Apple's able to expand that capability and make it a little bit better, that's a good thing. So pulling Genius into this is great. And then finally in the news for this week, we have some movement on Apple Maps. You know, Apple Maps got off to a rough start, but I think it's improved vastly over the years. And Apple has kind of said that they were going to double down on Maps. And it looks like they're getting pretty serious because some new vehicles were spotted in Los Angeles this week. In the past, Apple seemed to be using exclusively Ford Transit vans. I know some of you have sent me photos of those Apple vehicles, those vans driving around in your area. As a matter of fact, I remind people that you can actually go to maps.apple.com/vehicles, and they list, you know, not specifics, you're not going to get geo-coordinates or anything like that, but they do list by country and by region and area and by date range where Apple is actually operating their mapping vehicles. And I assume now these new mapping vehicles, the old ones had kind of a horizontal array of 360-degree cameras and LiDAR on the, you know, top edge of the van, almost like on rails. The new vehicles are much smaller. It looks like they're using Subaru Impreza hatchbacks, and these have more of the pole sticking up out of the top with a little, you know, almost looks like a Mac Pro, like a trash can with a curved domed lid, but basically a little LiDAR array and 360-degree camera array, very much more Google-esque. If you've ever seen the Google Maps cars driving around in your area, these look very much like those at this point. And Apple seems to be running those around. At least that's what's been spotted in LA. So I don't know if this is upgraded systems or the same kind of technology, just in a smaller vehicle. Also, these are not to be confused with the other vehicles Apple has roaming around, mostly I think in the Bay Area because that's where they have licensing to do it. But the vehicles that they use for their autonomous driving program or autonomous systems program are still the Lexus SUVs, as far as I know. So if you see those driving around instead of the vans or the little Subarus, that is for that effort. And actually, Apple clearly marks on all of its mapping vehicles, I think it does say maps.apple.com somewhere on there. And then not only do they seem to be running around in smaller vehicles now, but they're actually attaching rigs to humans. A Mac Rumors reader spotted an iBackpack Man. That's my name for him. Nobody else called him that. But I'm going to call him iBackpack Apple Maps Man in San Francisco. He had a backpack, and out of the top of it was a rig, guess what, featuring LiDAR, GPS, and multiple cameras, 360-degree cameras. It was pretty fascinating. And, you know, Google did this years and years ago. So Apple seems to be finally catching up to Google in terms of how it's running people around. Actually having folks on the ground is actually a pretty big part of this. I believe people in the cartography world call this ground truthing, right? Actually verifying the data that you get with humans on the ground and making sure that makes sense. You know, I don't think ground truth is specifically guys walking around in backpacks. Let me make it clear on that. But the point is that you kind of have the data capture, which is the backpack and the cars running around, and then you have human beings that are going in and verifying and validating and double checking and make sure that road, yeah, that's where it is. Something hasn't moved, something hasn't changed, and that sort of stuff. So you combine all that stuff together, and that's how you get accurate mapping data. And you remember Eddie Q, as I said earlier, did tell the media that Apple is focused on building, quote, the best map app in the world. And I can only assume that these new platforms and data collection methods are part of the effort that is going to try to make that happen. Now the question becomes, when do we get to see it, and when will the proof be in the pudding, as it were? Because I think currently, if you still ask anybody in terms of just technology and things like Street View and stuff like that, Apple still is kind of trailing behind Google. Although, again, they're doing much, much better. I have far less issues with Apple Maps now than I did in the past. And I've heard similar things from those of you out there, but I don't think it's perfect in every region. So, you know, if you have feedback on this, as always, you know, you can email me. So send those along. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Capterra. You know, back when I was working for Upper Deck, yeah, the trading card company, I actually did some web development for them, building websites and digital products. There was a time when I remember my boss came to me and said, "Hey, we're going to need you to help write and develop a patent or a couple of patents for some processes and systems that we were actually developing within my department." And I remember thinking, I know nothing about patents or the patent process. This is going to be kind of crazy. How am I possibly going to do this? Of course, you know, they provided some training and I dug in online and did my research and I learned what I needed to get the job done. And so ultimately it worked out. But point is that, you know, we're all bound to face at some point unexpected hurdles at work. But you don't want to let finding the right software be one of those hurdles for you. And with 2019 fast approaching, you don't have time for unexpected hurdles that could derail you. So if you need to find the right software for your business fast, Capterra can help with that. And as a matter of fact, they have a free ebook, the Big Book of Free Software, which you can download now for free at capterra.com/Maccast. Capterra is a source, a free source, for you to help find the software you need for your business. And with helpful information on over 300 different software tools, their Big Book of Free Software can help you find a completely free tool to test out today. And it's absolutely free, so you don't even have to worry about asking your boss for a single penny. So whether you're looking for a new project management tool, recruiting software, an email marketing solution, Capterra's Big Book of Free Software has something for you. Visit capterra.com/maccast today to get your free copy of the Big Book of Free Software. That's Capterra, CAPTERRA.com/maccast for your free copy of that book. And a big thank you to Capterra for their support of the Maccast. We're going to kick off the feedback portion of the show today with some feedback from a few of you on two-factor authentication and some of the issues. We had a listener on, I think it was the last episode of Maccast, who was having some problems after erasing his device before setting up his new one with two-factor authentication and getting the text message to come in. And several people told me that, well, I guess we should review a little bit probably. On that last episode of the Maccast, what I had recommended, because he had not set up the new device or transferred the SIM to the new device yet, was that he move the SIM to his new device and then just simply skip the iCloud setup, which is the point where you're required to go through your two-factor authentication, skip through it so that he could get to the Messages app to get to the text message, which would have the code, because this device was a trusted device, or the one that was attached to the number on that SIM card was a trusted device within his iCloud account, and then he could get the code, and then he could use that to sign in and set up iCloud after the, you know, automated onboarding process that you go through when you're setting up a new device. Well, several people wrote in to tell me that actually, had he transferred the SIM before doing the setup or before trying to set up the new phone, that the whole process would have worked fine anyway, because when it pops up and says log in to your iCloud account, right, and you go to get that code, you can click the didn't get a code option on the sign up screen, you know, because at that point iCloud wasn't set up. And again, reminder, he didn't have any other devices attached to his iCloud account. It was only his iPhone. And there were reasons for that, so please don't email me again. We've gone through that, or go back and listen to the last episode of the MacCast. But he could go get the text option, and then it would send the code to his trusted number, which would now be that new iPhone. And if you use iOS 11.3 or later on your iPhone, it actually auto-enters that number from the text message. So it would just automatically handle it for him. He wouldn't have to skip through that process, and iCloud would be perfectly set up. I did not know that that worked. I hadn't gone through that process. So that's a thing to do and a way to get around that. I also heard from Bart Bouchatz, and he pointed out a couple of things. One, we had had the conversation about adding additional numbers. I think the caller had asked if there was a way, or didn't know if there was a way to add additional phone numbers to your verification. And Bart pointed out, yep, that's actually pretty easy. You can add additional phone numbers or trusted numbers to your account simply by logging into your Apple ID account at appleid.apple.com. And then they're going to the security section where you can add trusted numbers. And what's cool is, and the other thing that Bart pointed out, was that you can add not only text numbers, but you can also add telephone numbers so that you can actually get a phone call with the code over a voice line rather than just a text message. So that means you could add something like a cell phone number or even a work number or a home number. So when you're setting up the trusted number, you actually have a binary choice that gets made. Do you want this to be a number for a text message, or do you want this to be a number for a voice message? And I think I had also commented to say I wasn't sure how you got the voice call. Well, this is how you get it. You, in advance, set up the trusted number with either option. So if you set up the voice number, what happens is when you request the passcode, rather than getting a text message, you'll get an automated phone call, and it will actually read the number back to you. So that's a great way to set up an alternate number in case you're worried, hey, I'm going to be somewhere where I can't get a text message or something like that. And that kind of plays into another comment or another thing that Daniel pointed out when he wrote in. That's another potential issue of using two-factor authentication or using a two-factor authentication method that sends codes via SMS. And I guess using the voice option is potentially another way to get around some of the issues with security surrounding SMS, although I guess a voice call could be intercepted as well. But what Daniel was pointing out was, you know, what happens if you use a two-factor authentication service that only offers a text message as an option, and you're at a point where you're trying to log into something, but you're not connected to a cellular network. Either maybe you're traveling abroad and the service is just too expensive. Maybe you're just out of service range. What are you going to do in that situation? Well, most of the time you would hope that your provider offers backup codes. And I'm pretty sure that iCloud does this. I know that, you know, services like Dropbox offer this. So when you set up two-factor authentication, it says, hey, if you ever forget the number or the passcodes, or you need a way to get into your account, here are some pre-generated, usually about 10 of them, backup codes. And you should store these backup codes somewhere safe or secure. I would say typically put them inside something like a secure note, or in my case, I use my password manager, 1Password. I actually store that right in with the username and password, right? In the notes field, I just put another field that's secure or backup codes and have the backup codes in there. And then you could just go into that app, whether you're offline or something, or whether you're out of range of getting a code, and you could use it that way. Of course, the ideal option is for the service to use an authenticator app, you know, the app on your phone that can actually generate those codes. And then you don't even have to worry about this, but there are a lot of services out there that require you to get a text message. Again, just remember to save those backup codes. If you're ever offered them, save them in a secure place that's local to your device that you can get access to, even if you're unable to connect to a data network. So that's another way to handle that. So you have a bunch of options. And the point is like, a big thing I want you to get out of this two-factor authentication conversation is that, yes, it does make things a little bit more challenging, but that's kind of the point, right? It is to provide an extra layer to secure your accounts so that if your password gets compromised, that you are still protected. And I think it's really important. Even with all the little hassles and stuff, a little upfront thinking and about a number of the things that we're bringing up here on the MacCast means that you're not going to have to worry about these weird edge case scenarios. You know, 90% of the time, you're not even going to fall into one of these problems. You're going to go to log into your account. You're going to be able to get and use your two-factor authentication code. Yes, there are some edge cases where it might become a little bit more challenging, but if you've done the upfront thinking about it and the upfront planning, you're not going to get caught in these traps. So listen to all the things that we're talking about here, and don't let any of this stuff scare you away from using two-factor authentication. I am a huge fan of it. Any account that offers it now, I am automatically turning it on without question. I've been using it for a few years now, and it has ultimately, again, probably 99% of the time, not really been an issue for me. Actually, 100% of the time, there's never been a situation because, again, I use the plan and I have backup codes. There's never been an issue where I haven't been able to get into an account. Occasionally, I've had to jump through a few more hoops, but again, for the added safety and security, I think it's well worth it. So take this, all of this information as advice and use it. Please don't let it be the thing that deters you from setting up or using two-factor authentication, because that really is not my point in all of this. And then one last little thing related to this, specifically with iCloud and how Apple has implemented two-factor authentication. If you do have additional trusted devices and you're unable to get the code from Apple's services, either the iCloud service or through one of the trusted phone numbers, I pointed this out in the past on the MacCast, but I want to remind people about this. Any device that you have that's set up as a trusted device, you can actually manually generate those codes from. So that can be your Mac, it can be an iOS device, and it's pretty easy to do. On your Mac, you go into System Preferences, into iCloud, and then click on Account Details, and then go to the Security tab, and then right in there, there is a link that says Get Verification Code. If you click that link, it will generate the code and present it to you right on your Mac. Similar thing for iOS. You can go into Settings, into iCloud, tap on Password and Security, and then tap on Get Verification Code. So you don't even have to wait for Apple to generate and send you a verification code. You could do it right from another trusted device if you have that around. So if you have one device you're trying to get into, you can use any other device and you can get that code manually. It's sort of like having a built-in Apple Authenticator code generating app right on every device that you have connected into your trusted network of devices. So that's another way to do these things. So a little bit of follow-up on the two-factor authentication stuff. A second thing that I want to follow up on is my comments about how I did a clean install, actually a extreme nuke and pave, what I call a nuke and pave clean install of macOS Mojave. And again, if you want to know the reasons for this and how I did it, go back and listen to the last episode of the MacCast. But the point was I basically completely erased, installed everything from scratch, and then brought all of my documents and everything over manually to my new macOS Mojave install. I also installed my applications from scratch. There was one little thing, though, I left out of that conversation that Eric wrote in to remind me about, and it's a potential gotcha for folks who go the nuke and pave option. And it has to do with permissions when you're bringing everything back over, especially if you have, or really only if you have multiple accounts set up on the Mac that you're upgrading from. So what happens is you want to remember what order you set those accounts up in, and on your new system, the one that you nuke and paved to, you want to set your accounts back up in the same order that you originally had them set up. The reason for this is under the hood, how the macOS and the operating systems handles permissions is each account actually gets assigned a user ID, a unique number. And I believe that number still starts at 501. So the first account that you create after setting up a new Mac gets the user ID 501, and then it goes to 502, 503 for each additional account that you set up on that system. It may be a little bit different than that, but you just need to know there's a unique user ID associated with each account, and that is what's used to handle some of the permissions that go on under the hood. So what can happen is when you set up your new system if you don't set up the accounts in the same order, and then you're copying from a clone backup or an old backup the folders and the documents and stuff over from that old system, there can end up being this mismatch of those underlying user ID numbers, and then you start to run into permissions issues on your new system. So this issue can occur, say, if you have an account, we'll just call it account A on your old computer, and that was number 502 on that system, but then you create it as the first account on your new system, and it gets assigned the ID of 501. So now you're copying the folders over, they're assigned to the wrong user ID. They're assigned to 502, and the account that you're trying to access them from is the 501 account. And you run into this permissions problem. Now, it's pretty easy to work around because you can go into the Finder, you can get info on your home folder, and you can, you know, just change the permissions and reassign them. But you might not want to do that. So probably the easier thing to do, like I said, is to reset up the accounts in the same order. If you don't remember, there is a simple terminal command that you can run that can help you. And before you upgrade, just go into your system, go into the terminal, type ID, and then space, and then the username of the account you want to get the ID number for. And you're going to get a long string that shows up when you hit enter. You're just looking for, I think it's the first item. It'll say UID equals, and then the number, probably 501 for the first account. And then in parentheses, it'll show you the username for that account so you know which account you're talking about. Just write those down in order. So you want to find 501, 502, 503. The numbers, again, might be different, but the point is get them in the order. And then just when you create them on your new system, create them in that order. And I think I have that right. I'm sure if I've gotten this wrong, Bart, I know you're listening, you're probably going to email me and correct me on a few things. But the ultimate point is, if you are doing a nuke and pave, be careful about how you're recreating your accounts. If you only have one account on your system, like I do, and this is why I didn't think to mention this last time, you're likely not going to run into this problem. So just pointed that out, and thank you, Eric, for writing in to remind us about that. I want to talk about screen time a little bit, a new feature in iOS 12. I think I talked about it on the last episode of the MacCast and mentioned that I'm really enjoying it. I'm using it with my kids' accounts, my family account, to kind of keep track of what's going on. And personally, I just, you know, I'm not using it to kind of control my behavior, but it's interesting to go in there and look and see, you know, what apps I'm using, how long I'm spending on social media, how long I'm spending in productivity apps. I have it all linked together and things like that. But it is a feature that a lot of parents were looking forward to because they want to be able to monitor and control their kids' screen time. And you can do things like limit which apps they can use at which times, limit the amount of time they're spending on devices, and limit the amount of time that they're spending on apps. And the reason I'm bringing it up again in this episode is there's a really cool article that was linked on NextWeb that was linked to from The Loop, and I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, that comments on a large Reddit thread that has cropped up among parents in the few weeks since iOS 12 came out about all, and it discusses all of the methods and ways that their kids are now finding that they could use to thwart the screen time controls that the parents have put into place. So when you set up screen time, it's also where the new parental controls are. So all of the parental controls for iOS are under screen time. You set a passcode and your kids are not supposed to be able to go in and change the settings. And most of the time it looks like that's not what's happening. But the stories in this thread I just found very interesting, and I thought it was worth talking about a little bit here on the MacCast. And I'd be curious to hear from some of you, especially those of you out there who are parents. You know, are your kids thwarting your screen time controls, and how are they doing it, and what are they doing? So a couple of the examples from this article that were very interesting was one kid figured out that, oh, well, you set a time limit per day on the app that I'm running. So, you know, my favorite game or whatever it might be, I hit the time limit, I no longer can use that app for the day, right? That's the idea behind the screen time control. What he figured out was that, oh, if I just delete the app and reinstall it, it resets the clock, so you can delete and reinstall. Of course, you, if you're somebody who knows about these things, you're thinking, well, why don't you just turn on the parental control that blocks app installs, and then your kid, or even app deletes, and then your kid can't delete and reinstall the app. So of course, there's countermeasures to this, but this is all the cat and mouse game that comes up. But So that's one thing. Another kid figured out that if you block apps like YouTube, again, with a time limit, so I only want the kid watching 30 minutes of YouTube videos a day or whatever the limit might be, kids have figured out that some of these apps exist also inside the Messages app. So there's a YouTube app for Messages, and that time doesn't count against YouTube app. It actually counts against the Messages app. So if the parent's not limiting the Message app or there's more time available on the Message app, you can go into the YouTube app inside Messages, send yourself basically text messages with YouTube links, and just use the YouTube app or watch the YouTube videos inside Messages. So I thought that was another clever little workaround. Another workaround, and of course, if you want to counter that, the idea would be, well, just block or set time limits on the Messages app as well, and then, you know, problem solved. So again, cat and mouse. But another one that parents haven't figured out how to work around is the kids simply going into the date and time settings on their device and actually tweaking those. So just rolling them back. The thing there is, I would talk to your kids, because this can actually have all kinds of bad ramifications on other apps that rely on dates and times. Things like reminders going out at weird times, schedules being off, alerts not happening at the right time, like all the other notifications and things that rely on date time can get really screwed up. So it's really not advised to go in and start tweaking the date time on your device. And I actually know this because one of my favorite games, Black Box, actually had me do this at one point, and then I started having weird things. So I've run into this before. So just be careful when you're like rolling back date and time to kind of work around issues or even deal with stuff like this. But, you know, we had this conversation about screen time on the Mac Observer's Daily Observations podcast. I'm a guest on there from time to time. And one of the things that we brought up was talking about screen time and parental controls and all these sorts of things. And I commented on that, you know, basically parental controls without the parent part are just controls, right? So the parenting part is a very good part of that equation. It's a very important part of that equation. Having the technology and the tools at your disposal to be able to manage that and set that up and provide deterrence and do all that stuff from a technical standpoint is really, really great. And the fact that Apple has expanded and added things like screen time, I think, is awesome. These are additional tools that we as parents can use to help in this effort. But ultimately, at the end of the day, those controls, as pointed out by this Reddit thread, and this is the main part of this conversation I wanted to have, they just point out the flaws in the system, right? It's like your kids are likely going to know more about this stuff than you are, and they're going to be very, very, very clever. They have a vested interest sometimes in trying to find ways around this stuff, right? They have a personal vested interest in working around this stuff. And where there is a will, there is a way. So what you have to deal with is the will, and that's where the parenting part comes into play. Like explaining why you want to have these controls in place. Why is too much screen time a bad thing? Or why do you feel that way? You know, make them understand your point of view, and you're going to be a lot more successful in implementing things like parental controls. And also just remember what it was like to be a kid at that age, right? We all did this stuff. Your parents would try and enforce rules and controls on you. And depending upon your feelings about those rules and controls, your actions would be guided in one way or another. Is this a rule that I'm going to choose to break at this moment because, well, my parents just don't understand? Or am I seeing things from my parents' point of view, and am I understanding it, and am I going to follow along and sort of play along with the game? And, you know, every kid is different. There's so many factors in this thing, but this is all about parenting, right? And when it comes back to the technologies are just tools and things that we have at our disposal, things that we can use to help with this stuff. So I don't know. That's kind of my take on it. I did find this interesting. Again, you'll find a link to the article and the full Reddit thread if you want to read more of these little stories and maybe share some of your own over on Reddit. You can do that. But share your stories with me, too, like in the community. I'd be curious to know how this is working out for you and the clever and creative things that kids do to get around this stuff. I just find it fascinating. I think it's actually a lot of fun. So send that feedback in, maccast@gmail.com. Another thing I want to talk about this week is voice assistants, and what I'm calling voice assistants now with faces. And specifically, if you've looked at, and this is coming up because Google announced a new product this week, which is a smart speaker, a version of their Google Home that has a screen on it now. So it's a smart speaker with a screen. Amazon already had the Amazon Show. And again, I was going through my feeds, and Stephen Hackett, who I think is an amazing dude, podcaster, he runs Relay FM, he does an amazing Mac blog over at 512 Pixels, just a smart guy. He wrote up an article over at iMore, because he's doing some writing for iMore now, and he wrote up a piece making the case for Apple doing a similar kind of product for the HomePod, basically the case for a HomePod with a screen. And I'll link to the article in the show notes at maccast.com so you can go kind of read his whole case. But I just wanted to comment on the idea of that and sort of my thoughts on it. I really kind of agree with him that there are certain situations where this could be handy, right? You have a HomePod, something sitting in a central area of your house, and you want to ask about the news, and it can then deliver not only audio, but maybe video content and news reports. It can display weather graphs. It could do other things. Maybe you're trying to get information on a recipe. Why not just show you a video on how to cook something or prepare something? Maybe you want to know how to do a certain kind of culinary cut with a knife, and it could actually offer up a video to you. So I can see the value in that, right? There is situations where having a screen attached to a voice assistant would be handy. Some of these systems also have a camera, so they're kind of positioned as a video conferencing tool. Specifically, Amazon's Echo Show does. I believe the new product from Google doesn't, and a little bit of that is a debate over privacy, right? Some people don't feel so comfortable having a device with a camera on it. I can't tell you how surprised I am how many times I see people who have a physical block or control over their eyesight camera. I think it's something that people often worry about. But I think that's a thing that's easily solved, right? If you remember, the original eyesight camera from Apple, the little Firewire tube shaped one, it had an awesome physical shutter. You literally twisted the front of the camera and it had an iris that shut. Why we don't have that on our Macs or a similar system on our Macs, it could even be kind of remote controlled through software. I think that would be really cool. So it'd be even cooler on something like a HomePod with a screen, because you could have voice control, right? You could just say, hey, stop watching me. And you could see a physical iris close up over the thing and block the camera and stay blocked, right? Make it obvious, make it a different color. It could be white. I think the one on the original eyesight was actually white, so you could actually see that it was closed and covered up, right? So that's not a problem. I think Apple could solve that. But my concern with the idea of a screen attached to a Siri Home Assistant has a lot to do with the history of Siri and her youth and the basically emotional baggage that I think current Siri suffers from even today. And it's the fact that early Siri was able to rely on a screen to present information. And it's why we still suffer from the, hey, here's the information, you know, I don't know anything about that, but here's some information I found on the web. And then she proceeds to display something to you on your device, right? There is not this sort of forced need to present the information in a voice assistant way, which would be audio, right? And I also feel kind of this is why Amazon with the Echo, which only relied on voice exclusively, was able in a lot of ways and a lot of its functionality to surpass Siri and come across as being quote unquote smarter than Siri. I've also heard that the Google Home is in a lot of ways better than Siri, because Google, it's not so much the voice part, but it is the fact that Google can tap into a vast wealth of search data that it has access to. Like, it has the Google has free, unfettered access to the world's data, right, through Google search, because all of these people and providers provide that data to Google. They want to get search rankings. They want people to find them. So they provide all of this stuff, right? And Google has parlayed that into becoming basically their data, right? You do a Google search now, and the big thing with Google is it wants to present that data, wherever the source came from, on Google.com or on the Google home. So then it becomes the question of, okay, Amazon was doing this voice stuff. Google has access to all this data. What does Apple have? And that's sort of where I'm at with this. Like, I don't want Apple to rely on a screen to present information at this point. Before they go make new things for Siri to run on, I think they need to make Siri, current Siri, a whole lot better at servicing the things that she does currently run on, specifically the HomePod. Like, let's fix those things before we go attaching and creating something different, you know, putting a screen onto Siri. We actually already have Siri with a screen attached. It's called an iPhone or an iPad, and it's far from perfect. So let's actually perfect it there. Let's make it work really good there, and then, you know, give her the screen and the additional functionality and information. It's a matter of doing one thing after the other. You know, if Apple can do all of these developments at the same time in conjunction and can do a HomePod with a screen and make it great, really, really great, then I'm actually all for it. And I would agree with Steven. But at this point, you know, I think there's still too much lacking, and I worry that it would be too much of a distraction. And engineers would take a step backwards and fall back on, well, we have a screen. We can just present the information to the user. We don't actually have to do the voice work and make this work like a human conversation. And that's really what it should do, right? It should be this sort of conversation. And that screen, I guess they could put sensors in there to detect if you're looking at it or not and then decide whether to present information. But I think the first point of an interaction with a voice assistant should be voice, right? And it shouldn't assume that you're looking at the thing. It should be able to do everything just with that voice. And that's where I think the HomePod and Siri is currently falling short. So I don't know. Do you agree with me? I do agree with a big assessment Stephen made in that article, which is that the future success of Siri really relies on developers and stronger integration with third-party apps and I think even more importantly, third-party data sources. I think that's another area that Siri suffers from, right, is Apple has limited access compared to somebody like a Google to certain amounts of information, right? And to make these conversations happen with a digital assistant, a voice assistant, that needs to get better. It needs to get infinitely better. And it can do that if Apple does more partnerships, opens up more support for third-party apps that maybe have a lot of that data, and just integrates better with the data that Apple already has on the device. Another big area where this needs to get stronger and where Google is excelling, multiple voice detection, right? The support for multiple users. The fact that that's not on the HomePod right now is a big issue because the HomePod's meant to be the central device that everybody in the family can tap into. But right now, its data is limited to a single user in a lot of ways, right? The calendar data on my HomePod is my calendar data. Well, my wife has her own, my kids have their own schedules, they have their own reminders, all of this stuff, right? And they need to be able to detect that. And Siri can detect voices. We know that already because you set up your Siri device and the Ola Siri doesn't get confused so much anymore, right? It's patterned to your voice. So the technologies and the capabilities are there. We need them implemented. And I think Apple needs to focus a lot more on improving the voice part before we move back to the screen part. And so that was my only point here. Again, I get the case for a HomePod with a screen. It could be really, really great, but it needs to be done very, very well. And I just don't want Apple to have the distraction at this point because I think they do need to focus a little bit more on this voice area. But that's just my thought. As always, what are your thoughts on this? And then lastly in the show for today, I want to bring up some apps that you maybe didn't know you had. This actually came about because I received an email from Ken who was looking for the old network utility app. Have you ever used this app? It was in your utilities folder. It used to happily live down there in applications / utilities, or just the utilities folder inside your applications folder on your Mac. But after some Mac OS update, I don't remember which version, honestly, it went MIA, right? Apple removed it. And actually, I think you could access it if you were having trouble with your network or through certain areas. And Ken was like, I was looking for it the other day and I found it. I know where it is. And it's still there on your Mac. But even if you do a spotlight search, it's not going to find it. Actually, you might be able to do, if you do a spotlight search in the Finder, or a Finder search rather, I guess that would be, and you use the options, there is a way to tell the Finder to search for system items. Those are often items that are hidden inside the system folders. And that's actually the answer here and the thing that Ken sent me. I actually did know about this because I go in there and access another app I'll tell you about in a little bit. And I like to make sure that that's available on my Mac. But if you're looking for your network utility or some of what Apple calls their core services applications, you're not going to find them in the standard applications folder. Where you're actually going to find them is inside the root system folder. So the top level system folder, inside its library folder, there's a folder called core services. And inside core services, there are applications. So in there, you will find the network utility. You also find other applications like About This Mac. Yeah, that's the one when you go under the Apple menu and say About This Mac. That's actually a little application that runs and it lives inside the core services folder. You also find in there now, and I didn't know this until, and I don't know if this happened in Mojave or earlier, but I noticed the DVD player is now in there. So if you have an external DVD player, typically what happens is you plug in a DVD or insert a DVD, it automatically launches this application out of the system, so you never really have to manually launch it. But if you wanted to know where it lives now inside this core services folder. Also, the RAID utility, if you want to set up a RAID drive, is in there. The app that I was mentioning earlier that I always pull out of there, or actually I just put it into my dock, is the screen sharing app. Built-in screen sharing app, which, you know, you can also launch if you have networked drives. If you select those in the Finder, right, you get the screen sharing button or the screen sharing option. That will launch this application. I like to have it in my dock because it's a great general application for any VNC server. It's actually just a VNC client, and so you can use it to connect to a VNC server, so you can launch it from there. But again, Ken was looking for the network utility. In case you don't know what the network utility is or what it does, its name kind of gives it away a little bit. It can give you general information on your network interfaces, so like the Ethernet port in your Mac or the Wi-Fi card, the airport card in your Mac. You can get general information on that. Really, you know, nerdy system level information. A lot of stuff that you could also access through terminal commands in the terminal. But it also has a couple different tools available in a nice GUI. Tools like doing a ping of a server, or if you want to trace route to a server or an IP address, you want to do a whois lookup on a domain, you want to maybe port scan an IP or a domain, you can do all of that stuff inside the network utility. Again, you Unix nerds out there probably know how to do all this stuff also from terminal commands, but this puts a nice user interface on it. So, you know, there's various reasons you might want to use those tools. In my web development work, I'm often looking up whois records to figure out, you know, who owns a domain or something like that. And so I use network utility on occasion for that, but oftentimes I'm just doing it through a web browser, however it might be. But there's a couple applications in there. You know, I didn't mention all of them. You can go take a peek for yourself and see what's in there. And that's where you find them. Again, a lot of these can be accessed from other windows or other panels. I think the system information panel, again, if you choose About This Mac, the little system information application, I believe, is also in that location. But you can do About This Mac and then click System Report and access it the same way. I think another one that I noticed in there was the file manager, you know, looking for large files on your system. The little application for that is in there. So if you want to access them, excuse me, more directly, you could do it through going through the core services applications folder in the system library folder. So there you have it. And thanks, Ken, for sending in that tip. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. I do want to say a quick thing to Patreon supporters. You know, this show at this point would not be possible literally without the direct support that I am getting from Patreon supporters. They help keep the lights on here at the MacCast. It pays for a lot of the daily maintenance stuff and servers and things like that that I need to deal with to run the MacCast full time. So if you do enjoy this podcast and you want to support its future development, you can visit patreon.com/MacCast and pledge your support there. There's some suggested levels, but you can give any amount you want. Really, a pledge of just 25 cents an episode, a buck a month, means a whole lot to the show and to myself and my family. So I thank all of the current supporters. And if you're able to support, that is great and wonderful. Please don't take this as a plea or a feeling that you need to financially support the show in any way. This show happens whether or not you do that. I do it because I love the community. I love the Mac. I love creating this show. I've been doing it for almost 15 years at this point, so I wouldn't have been doing it this long if I didn't love doing it. Just listening and participating in the MacCast community is more than enough support. So don't feel it's that, but if you are able to, it really is appreciated. It does really go a long way to make the show happen. It makes things a lot easier on me, not having to worry about those bills and stuff like that. So if you can do it, great. You can also help the show simply by commenting or, on iTunes, leaving a review, writing a review, emailing in comments and questions to the show, recommending the show to your friends and family. Every little bit helps. So if you know someone who you think really would like the show and benefit from it, please pass it along. Let them know how to subscribe. Teach them. And I'll just finally say, it's an honor and privilege of mine to be able to bring you this show each week, and I feel incredibly lucky that in every way that you've provided me the opportunity to be able to do this. So just thank you to all of you who download and listen to the show. I really, really do appreciate it, and I probably don't say that enough, so I wanted to make sure we took care of that in this episode. One other thing, and something else that helps me do this show, of course, is our sponsors. I want to thank Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, for their continued support of the podcast. Also, Text Expander and PDF Pen for your iOS devices, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, or just a question for me, you can email your audio comments and your questions to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. If you'd prefer to use Skype, I do have a Skype voicemail. You can phone in on Skype. My Skype username is TheMacCast, so just use that and leave a voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me between shows on social media, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.